Now, the main health sector unions are to seek an urgent meeting with the HSE after doubt was cast this week as to whether a 3% pay rise due to be paid and backdated to the start of February will be paid in time for Christmas. SIP2 described the uncertainty faced by the HSE's more than 100,000 employees, many of them frontline health workers, as unacceptable. And Damien Ginley is SIP2 sector organiser for Support Grades. Good morning, Damien.
Good morning, Owen, and good morning to your listeners.
So the SIP2 union arguing that the tone of the HSE's communications about the matter have suggested a lack of urgency on its part. Explain further.
That's right, Owen. SIP2 and the Health Service Staff Panel of Unions have been engaging with the HSE in recent weeks over a growing concern around delays being experienced in relation to the application of the pay increases due to workers in the health service. And by way of background, I think it's important to remind everybody that during the summer, we entered into a national negotiation to reach an agreement to afford all public service workers modest pay increases to try and address some of the growing challenges associated with the cost of living crisis. And those increases were set out as follows. There was a 1% sectoral bargaining fund due to all public service workers from the 1st of February. There was a 3% pay increase due to workers from the 2nd of February. And there was a further 1% or €500, whichever was greater, due to apply to the annual pay scales from the 1st of October. And the challenge we're experiencing at the moment is one whereby our members are getting deeply concerned and frustrated, and there's a growing anger in relation to the delays and time it's taken to have those awards applied to our members. And that's resulting in a lot of frustration, because obviously all our members were informed when they voted on the proposals that this was a good deal as presented by the government to address some of the challenges associated with the cost of living crisis. But it's only a good deal if people receive the money to allow them to utilise that income in addressing that challenge. And it's the frustration that's grown now, because the HSE cannot confirm and haven't confirmed in detail as to when all those increases will fully be paid to our members.
I understand the HSE wrote to staff on Monday regarding the sectoral bargaining increases and also the 3% increase. What did those letters entail from the HSE?
Yeah, correspondence, there's been updates issued based on pressure coming from the staff panel of unions to try and get the HSE to take seriously the concerns that are being raised. So a communication was issued to all workers, which basically outlined that the 1% sectoral bargaining fund will be paid out in the next couple of weeks. And some members are thankfully beginning to see some of that at the moment. However, in relation to the 3%, it was suggested in the communication that this payment may arrive in the week of Christmas, in the lead up to Christmas, if it does arrive. And furthermore, it would only cover basic pay. So for a lot of health service workers, obviously due to the nature of the service, work nights, they work weekends, they work public holidays, etc., to supplement their basic pay. And the suggestion in the communication from the HSE is that their focus is on applying the increase to the basic income of our members only, as opposed to the totality of the income. And that's something we're deeply concerned with. It's also worth noting that we're getting a lot of communication from our members who work in Section 38 or voluntary organisations, the likes of organisations based in our community, providing services to clients with intellectual disabilities. And their employers are saying to them that the HSE have not transferred funding to allow for those employers to pass on the increases to their workers. So we have thousands of workers in that sector as well who are waiting on payments. And in addition, there's been no comfort given to all the retired health service pensioners who equally are waiting on these payments to be made and haven't seen anything to suggest that money is forthcoming in the coming weeks. And
so the HSE has described the situation with regard to the 3% as, in quotes here from an article in the Irish Times, more challenging. However, said that every effort is being made to implement the basic pay increase for all pay groups across December pay dates. Do we have any reason as to why the HSE are finding it more challenging to pay that 3%? Is it down to funds?
I think it's just down to a lack of urgency within the HSE to address this matter in the first instance. The matter is also complicated because due to the sparse nature of the HSE across the totality of the state, there's over 9 different payroll systems in operation, each of which have manual interventions to allow for pay adjustments to take place. But I suppose the frustration we would be getting from our members is based on the fact that the HSE were aware, for example, of the 1% pay increase or €500, which is ever was greater, that pay increase was due under the previous public service agreement and was due to be the last phase of that. So the HSE had over 12 months, 18 months to have structures in place to deal with that. I know there was obviously additional negotiations which took place during the summer, but again, in the civil service and in the public service, measures have been put in place to ensure those workers are rightly paid in a timely manner, and those workers have received those payments to the best of our understanding.
Okay,
so it's just our frustration is that there seems to be a lack of urgency in relation to this, and the communication that you referred to earlier suggests that the 1% October payment may not be paid until quarter one of 2023, which ultimately could lead to March of next year.
Yeah.
And when the government obviously, you know, applaud this agreement as one to address the challenge of the cost of living crisis that's here and now, getting the payment in 5-6 months' time is not going to help our members here and now in relation to dealing with that.
The three main unions in the health sector, SIPTU, FORSA and the INMO, had sought a meeting with the HSE's National Director of Human Resources by the end of last week, but were told it didn't happen. And again, quoted in this piece in the Irish Times, Kevin Figgis of SIPTU said that the unions will be writing to the HSE again to seek a meeting as a matter of urgency. Do you know, Damien, whether or not that letter has been written?
The correspondence has been issued, but we have no confirmed date of a meeting at this stage in relation to addressing these concerns. There is regular discussions ongoing between the staff panel and the general HSE, if you like, but we're seeking a meeting with the National Director's Office to try and impress on that person the urgency that this matter needs to be dealt with, because the health service is dealing with a very challenging situation at the moment in relation to overcrowding, in relation to available resources. And to add fuel to that fire, we're now being told that our members will not receive the payments that they voted on and that the government committed to honour in a timely manner. And it is very difficult for our members at the moment because, as everybody knows, the cost of living crisis is real at the moment, and our members are seeing their rent increase, they're seeing their mortgage repayments increase, and these payments that were due to be put in place to try and offset some of those challenges are not forthcoming. And it's very worryingly for and frustrating for our members that no urgency is being created by the HSE to address this matter.
Okay, SIPTU sector organiser for support grades, Damien Ginley, with that update. Thanks, Damien, for joining us, and good morning. Another message into us then on 0833 97 97 97, this time actually on the WhatsApp. It says, we as SNAs received our backdated pay as negotiated. It was paid with our fortnightly wages, so most of this payment was in turn paid in taxes, which is very frustrating. I'd also like to hear from some healthcare workers, if you've been tuned into us this morning. What's your view on it? What's your experience of those pay issues? 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
A new survey has provided insight into the experiences of men going through fertility treatment, the first of its kind run by Sims IVF. The survey, which was carried out online with over 400 respondents, compared responses and the experiences of men and women under the headings of external pressures to reach milestones in life, what they struggled most with during treatment, and how comfortable they would be discussing their fertility journey outside of their relationship. Well, Dr. Alex Aldape is Clinical Director of Sims IVF, and he's on the line now. Good morning to you, Alex.
Hi, good morning to everyone.
Thanks for joining us. Now, the results highlighted that even though the focus is often on women in heterosexual relationships during fertility treatment, that men are experiencing similar emotions and similar concerns.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the reason why we came with this idea of doing this survey is because, you see, sometimes we are kind of focusing too much on women, and we have to say that male, we are suffering in silence too. The process is very unique when it comes to doing treatments, IVF cycles or assessments even. So it is important also to kind of put the focus also on men, because actually what amazed us more is that actually that the results, they were kind of mirroring what's happening with women. So actually men also, they struggle to communicate this to colleagues. They struggle to communicate this to their families as well.
Is this to do with stigma, maybe, or some people might feel embarrassed or ashamed, which I know is something that you would deal with and see quite regularly and talk to people saying that this is not something that you need to be ashamed of and we're here to help. But do you think maybe that's why the conversation is difficult to have?
I think it's a mix of factors. You see, it's just like on both sides, when they come to clinics, In a way, the female, but also male, they know that they have kind of to perform. You see, there is like kind of a benchmark when it comes to the semen assessment. So they always struggle, like, oh my God, my semen sample should be better than this in order to go to IVF, to ICSI. It's a mix of things. And then, of course, there is this emotional side of the treatment. That, to be honest, we do not focus too much on that one. And that was the reason why we said, okay, we need to get this information rather than taking decisions based on intuition to see what's going on. But I have to say, to answering that question, it is a mix of factors, not only a stigma, but also the fact that when patients are coming to the treatments, that they have this pressure that they need to perform.
I note as well, the feedback from your patients often depicts the male partner as having a more passive involvement in treatment. You know, the woman might have to visit the clinic more often. There's more treatments involved with her, whereas the male is really only involved at the start of the process.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Traditionally, that was the old way of doing fertility, which is just pretty much focusing on women. Women are the ones that they're coming more to the clinic. But and then we were just under the impression that for men we'll be just coming here, producing the sperm sample, and that's it. But that's absolutely not what we want to do. We want to have more. We want to acknowledge and we want to tell to everybody that, of course, male also, they are our patients too, and we need to focus on them. We need to focus on their needs. And sometimes they're coming to the office, just sharing some stories and sharing some experience that they have previously, and that was the reason why we say, okay, we need to get better data to see exactly what we can offer, how we can tailor the treatment plan for including men as well, and how we can have a better holistic approach for them as well.
Okay, if we go back to the findings then of this survey, male respondents struggled slightly more with telling their family and friends about receiving fertility treatment. 73% said it was difficult, while 62% of women said it was difficult in contrast. Were you surprised at all to see maybe men found it harder to speak about it, or is that something that you would have expected?
Well, I would say that, it's kind of close, 68 and 62. I would say that probably that was a little bit expected, because you see, somebody has to be like the strong when it comes to the couple, and sometimes we just want to kind of, as I said, it's just like men, my impression is that they are suffering in silence, but that was the reason of doing this survey. And yeah, I'm not so surprised with that outgoing that question particularly.
Okay, what else did it find then, or what other questions did you pose to men and women in the survey?
So it was a really kind of broad spectrum of questions, but other that they were interesting to see, it was when it comes to the milestones that they need to achieve during life. And as you can see, there is more pressure on women's side. What we have here is that 44% of the males, they responded that they don't feel this pressure of kind of having milestones during life, compared to 76% of women. So, yeah, it's just we are getting a more comprehensive view of how we are dealing with patients, of course, and how patients, particularly for male side, how they feel when it comes to doing treatments as well.
Some people already getting in touch with us on the text line to say that, you know, they've had experiences of IVF and very, very positive experiences as well. There might be a perception, Dr. Aldape, that perhaps when somebody goes through this, or somebody, a couple, say, realises that they are infertile or they can't conceive naturally, that that's the end of the road. But that's not the case.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the thing is, like, Yeah, it's just, you see, it's a difficult diagnose to get, of course. It's a lot to take in because the main problem is that we are taking fertility for granted. It's just like that it shouldn't be that complicated to get pregnant, right? But then when it comes to the facts and when we're seeing that, it's more than 1 year, not getting there, well, getting that diagnosis, of course, is very, very frustrating and disappointed. And that is the reason why, as I said previously, we normally focus more on women, but now it's time definitely to kind of having a better understanding about what's going on with male, because we do believe that what is happening now is that they're getting a lot of pressure too, but most of the times we forget about them because as we were saying also, it's just like traditionally it was just come to the clinic once or twice, just produce a sperm sample and that's it. But we need to see this more inclusive. We need to acknowledge that they are our patients too. We need to kind of tailor the treatment plan in a way that they are also feeling involved as well as part of the treatment. I think that's the main point of doing this survey to get more information about it.
Okay, if we may just talk about fertility treatment then in general, and what might cause a person, a man or a woman, to be infertile? What are some of the common causes there? And there's often no symptoms.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. So the most common will be more related to age factor. Okay, and then of course there is this idea that of course age only matters for women. And we're saying, okay, when women are above 40, 35 years old, that potentially they kind of struggle more to get pregnant. But you see, what we know is actually for men as well. Men, when they are above 35 years old, also we know that not only the semen assessment, but also all the parameters on the semen assessment, they can kind of drop a bit. So essentially, the most common will be age, but there's other kind of stuff like not having, for instance, good sperm production, not having good motility, good morphology. Those could be environmental factors that could be related to diet, that could be related to other kind of things or medical background. That is the reason why it's very important to have a good assessment, and that is the reason why it's important to get a consultation to see exactly what's going on. There is something that is called mixed factor when it comes to, could be on both sides of the couples as well.
Okay, and then finally, talk us through the fertilization process then, if people are listening and maybe want to go down this route. How does that work?
Yeah, so essentially the way it works is that once we are getting patients that they want to come to the clinic, what we do is normally we organize an initial consultation. So in that initial consultation, it's very important to get the medical history first to see if there's anything in the background that is kind of causing infertility or that can harm the fertility of both of them. At the same time, what we do is that we request some investigations. There is about something that is required for that particular couple. Sometimes it's about evaluating not only the AMH, which is kind of the ovarian reserve of females, but also the semen assessment, DNA fragmentation. There are several investigations that we can do. Once we're getting those investigations, we get the diagnosis, and with that one, we prepare a treatment plan. So we're talking about a process of one or two appointments. It all depends on the information that they can bring with them, and also it all depends of particularly what is the situation with the couple, where they are struggling to get pregnant.
Okay, well listen, it's been great talking to you this morning, very insightful, and that new survey has been released, providing an insight into the experiences of men going through fertility treatment compared to women as well. And that is Dr. Alex Adalpe, of Clinical Director of SIMS IVF. Thanks for your time this morning, and good morning to you. Now, there's a number of messages that are after coming in to us on 0833 97 97 97, and going back to the chat that we had with Damien Ginley of SIP2, regarding health workers seeking a meeting with the HSE over fears that their pay rise won't be received by Christmas. A healthcare assistant says, "Good morning. I received my backdated pay last week of €76. I also received 9 cent an hour pay rise. I earn under €30,000 a year. I don't think these pay rises are going to help with the present cost of living crisis. It's an absolute insult," says this listener. Rose was in touch to say, "I spent 18 hours in A&D in Naas Hospital recently. Not complaining about that though, but it opened my eyes to see the strain that those nurses and doctors are under. It's a crying shame that we would like to put, or I would like to put, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly in there for that length of time. Let him see what's happening at A&Ds. Just one observation in that time. Didn't see a number of, okay, I understand what you're saying there. I won't read that out, but you were saying that the doctors were so nice to make you realise what's happening and, you know, just highlights the issues there within the hospitals. But you spent 18 hours in A&E in Naas Hospital, and we've actually had emails in from Naas saying to people, if you can at all, go to other healthcare professionals such as doctors or out of hours services because of the extreme pressure that Naas Hospital are under.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Well, today marks the 100th anniversary of the execution of Robert Erskine Childers, the British-born gun runner and father of former President Erskine Childers. And there are some Kildare connections as well here, and we're going to talk about some of those now with local historian Liam Kenny, who joins us. Good morning, Liam.
Yeah, good day, Owen, and to your listeners all over Kildare and the adjoining county.
I was reading a piece on the RTE website by Donald Byrne, who described Erskine Childers as an enigma, a man who signed up for the Boer War because he believed in the British Empire when it was at its most powerful, but subsequently became impassioned by the case for home rule in Ireland. We'll get to that in a few moments about the political tasks and tribulations of Erskine Childers. But first of all, who was he? A bit of the background here.
Yeah, well, Erskine Childers was born into a solidly conservative English background. He was born in 1870 in England and went to Oxford, where he graduated in law, then got a very prestigious position as a clerk in the House of Commons. So right at the heart of the British machine, if you like, in that role. There would be a distant connection to Kildare in that he was a cousin of Robert Barton of Glendalough, and the Bartons in turn would be related to the Bartons of Strafford House and the well-known Barton and Gestier wine label. So there are connections there.
How did Erskine Childers get involved in politics then? When he comes to Ireland, how do things move along that way?
Yeah, well, as you quoted there, he is a complex figure, very, if you like, British, right up to and including the period of the First World War, where he was involved in the Royal Naval Air Service in very dangerous operations with primitive seaplanes and later torpedo boats. And yet, at about the same time, he was shown strong sympathies to the Irish nationalist movement. It is said that a trip that he and his cousin Robert Barton took to the west of Ireland in 1908, where they saw appalling deprivation and poverty, began to turn his mind away from the British Empire and so on to justifying a cause for an independent Ireland. And initially, he would have gone through the stage of home rule, which was independence through political means. But he began to see that the British government would be reluctant to give that. And he realised that Irish nationalists need to be armed. So he took part in one of the most celebrated gun smugglings of all time when he and his American wife, Molly, sailed a yacht known as the Asgard, a very well-known name in nautical terms, from off the coast of Holland and landed arms for the Irish Volunteers in Howth Harbour in 1914. But he was complex. There he was smuggling arms for the Irish Volunteers, which would be used against the British, and yet a couple of years later, he goes back into British uniform as the British officer in their Navy and Air Service during the First World War. So when his final break, if you like, with the British establishment took place, seems to have been about 1919, when he moved, he and his wife Molly, who was a little reluctant at first, but from London to Dublin. And became involved with Sinn Féin and the IRA of the time. He had a talent for publicity. He'd be what we'd call now a spin doctor, I suppose. And became the IRA's director of publicity. When the IRA made a truce with the British in the summer of 1921, there was, of course, the whole build-up to the treaty negotiations in London in December of 1921. And he was close to De Valera, and he was nominated as the chief secretary to the Irish negotiators. Now, he wasn't a negotiator himself, but his cousin Robert Barton was, as, of course, was Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith and so on. Now, he made himself unpopular during the treaty negotiations by, although he was a secretary in an official role, nonetheless being very opposed to the final settlement of that treaty. And he really annoyed Arthur Griffith, who was the head of the Irish delegation, and so on, and also indeed the British, who felt that he was somebody of their background who had now, if you like, turned against them. So the treaty party comes back home in the Christmas of 1921, and then you have the very high voltage treaty debates in the Dáil in January of 1922. And Childers is vehemently against the treaty. It's not only accepted and so on, and De Valera, who was anti-treaty, took his supporters, including Childers, out of the Dáil. And that was the beginning of a split, which was to become more and more serious during the spring of 1922 and break into all-out civil war. And Erskine Childers found himself down in Munster, where the anti-treaty forces were attempting to hold out against the pro-treaty, or indeed the new Irish Free State Government led by Griffith and Collins. Now, he seems to be involved in producing an anti-treaty news sheet and that kind of operation. But at some stage in the autumn of 1921, he decides that he has to come back up to the family estate in Glendalough, County Wicklow, and he cycles the distance there over a couple of hundred miles. But he's barely arrived in Glendalough when someone tips off the Free State Army, who swoop on the estate and capture him. Now, some weeks before, the new Free State pro-treaty government had passed very severe laws to try and deal with the lawlessness that was there during the Civil War. And basically, anybody found in possession of a weapon was liable to summary execution. And he was found in possession of a small pistol, which, as it said, Michael Collins had given to him as a gift. Now, really, this was a slender basis on which to commit him to the death penalty. But it seems that people, especially on the pro-treaty side, he had really, you know, annoyed them by his behaviour in frustrating their attempts at a settlement with Britain. That was enough reason, in their view, to give him a summary trial and then his execution on the 24th of November.
Well, I'd be right in saying as well, Liam, that at this stage he was serving as a Sinn Féin TD for the Kildare Wicklow constituency, as it would have been back at the time.
Well, yeah, he was elected at the second Dáil in the general election in 1921 to what was, as you say, the combined Kildare-Wicklow constituency. But he lost that seat in a general election in June of 1922. So he had lost the seat by this stage.
Okay, so the 24th of November 1922 was when Erskine Childers was executed, which is this day 100 years ago. Was the executions, or were the executions that were carried out at that stage, Liam, legal, or essentially were they murder?
Well, that is something that I suppose legal historians would argue over. The government of the day had passed a resolution providing for martial law or military law, and that a military court could convict somebody found in possession of arms or operating to undermine the new Irish state. But by modern standards, I suppose, of what we consider jury trials and human rights and so on, it was a questionable conviction. But it has to be, I suppose, seen in the context of there were over 70 such executions during the period of the Civil War from 1922 into 23, including one that I know you'll be covering in December, the execution of seven men in the Curra following activities disrupting the railway lines in Kildare, and so on. So, look, there were hard times. And people felt that hard measures had to be taken to try and bring some law and order to the new state.
So take us through what happened then on this day 100 years ago, the execution of Erskine Childers then, Lee.
Yes, well, he's taken to Beggars Bush Barracks in Dublin 4. And it is said that shortly before he was executed, on the night before, his son, also Erskine, visited him, and that the Erskine senior said to his son not to hold any bitterness to the men who signed his death warrant. And of course, Erskine Jr. became President of Ireland in the 1970s, and some of your listeners might remember a visit that Erskine Childers made to Eadstown Field Day, which was then in a field opposite Naas Racecourse on the Tipper Road. And it was an unusual enough thing for the President of Ireland to be visiting local festivities like that. In any event, Erskine Senior, the following day, the 24th, and it is said that he said to the firing squad, you know, advance a yard, it'll be easier that way. And he was shot and executed. A man with a brilliant mind, he had written in 1904-1905 the best-selling novel of its era, The Riddle of the Sands, based on, I suppose, an espionage story sailing the deltas of the coast of Holland, but also a complex figure who shifted from one side to the other in a short period of time.
There you have it. Excellent, as always, Liam, providing that overview of the 100th anniversary since the execution of Robert Erskine Childers, British-born gun runner and the father of former President Erskine Childers during the 1970s. And Erskine Senior was a Sinn Féin TD for the Kildare-Wicklow constituency. Liam, great to talk to you again, and thanks for that.
Thank you all. God bless.
Have your say now. Text or WhatsApp Kildare today on 0833 97 97 97.
And a couple of birthday requests that have come into us over the course of the morning. Could you please wish Jason Kelly in Ballyroe Athy a happy 15th birthday? Have a great day. Lots of love from Nan. Just want to wish my husband, Peter Weldon, a very happy anniversary. Lots of love from your wife, Amanda. And another one then that came into us a little bit earlier. Please play a birthday request for our daughter, Donna Gorry of Beach Park in Rathangan, who is half 100 today, from her sister, Evelyn, and her mother and father, Bridie and Dom Gorry in Woodlands in Rathangan, and all her family and friends. Have a fantastic day. So Donna Gorry, I'm not sure she'll thank you for telling people that she's half 100, but anyway, have a great, great day. And that comes in from all the family there. CEO of the Jack and Jill Foundation, Carmel Doyle, is on the line now. Good morning, Carmel.
Hi, Owen. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Listen, before we talk about the Christmas appeal, how did the Up the Hill for Jack and Jill fundraiser go?
It was superb, and a big shout out to Tina Priestley and all the team there. €130,000 raised, and thank you to all the hill walkers and the people who climb big hills, small hills, and somewhere in between. We couldn't do what we do without people, and they did it in solidarity with the 400 families we support who climb their own hill every day. And a big shout out to everybody for getting behind Jack and Jill. I mean, you've got Brendan Lachlan there, who's been doing the Naas 10K. I include him. He's been doing that for 9 years. So he's raised over $40,000 for Jack and Jill. We have wonderful local supporters in County Kildare, and we couldn't do what we do without them.
Yeah, he runs Brendan's Running Club in Naas, doesn't he?
Yes. he is the man. He's the Duracell bunny that keeps going. He's doing it for the 10th year next year, and we're actually going to have a big page on him in our annual report next year.
Brilliant.
And we actually, good news on our annual report, by the way, Owen, I digress, is we won a good governance award for our annual report last week, which was a huge privilege for us. We were up against some big competitors there, and it's great for the team to be recognised just for, not for the service we do and the money we raise, but through good governance that demonstrates we can show very good procedures and we always come back to where the money goes in Jack and Jill.
Super stuff. Well done to all involved on that award, and also in terms of the fundraising there for the Up the Hill fundraiser, because I know a lot of KFM listeners were involved there and they sent through some of the photographs of them climbing the hills around the county. You have quite an ambitious target for fundraising for your Christmas appeal.
Yeah, only €1 million.
That's all.
Only €1 million. Well, we've €6 million to raise in a year, so Christmas is our biggest time. But, you know, it would warm the cockles of your heart to see the people there in Johnstown, you know, and the calls we get into the office and the orders we're getting are just fabulous. There are some early Christmas shoppers already out there looking at our Christmas collection, our loot online, and we've got something for everybody there. And a big shout out also to our charity shops there in Newbridge as well, you know, because the charity shops and people who actually drop into Crookstown and into Newbridge, they are just phenomenal supporters. Community is at the heart of everything we do, and today we support 30 children in County Kildare and 400 across the country, and hats off to everybody.
This year is quite a significant year as well for the charity, Carmel.
Yeah, 25 years going. Jonathan Irwin set it up in 1997, and it was set up in memory and as a legacy to his son Jack Irwin, who was the Jack behind Jack and Jill. And Jack was born healthy but had some sort of an episode in the nursery and was oxygen deprived, and the child they got back the next day you know, had all sorts of care problems. He couldn't see, he couldn't talk. He lived for 22 months, and Marianne O'Brien, who actually was the founder of Lily O'Brien's there in the county as well, you know, they just wanted to be able to cope at home, and with the help of some local nurses, they were able to set up the blueprint, which has gone on to help 2,700 families across the country since Jonathan and Marianne were so brave to say, look, let's do this for other parents, because this can be quite a scary care journey that can be quite isolating when nobody really knows what to do, because typically you have a child who has 20 pieces of equipment. It's like having intensive care at home, you know, taking seizures, maybe high medication rate every day, a tube fed. But underneath all of this complexity, we know that these beautiful children do much better at home where their parents want them. The problem is you can't just ask an auntie or a neighbour to mind them. You need help as a parent so that you can get out and do a little bit of Christmas shopping or go to the Christmas play or all the other things that parents have to do these days. And that's what Jack and Jill nurses are all about. You go into the home at the invitation of the parents, and we make a real difference from day one.
And the good thing is, Carmel, yeah, exactly. Took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, no waiting list.
No means test. We will fund and deliver up to 80 hours per family. But the only thing, Owen, that's a big care responsibility, because if you look at the numbers, 400 across the country, 30 in Kildare, and those children will be with us for up to 6 years. You know, we have grown a lot over the last 25 years, but we're in the 6 million category now. But we are very proud of what we do, and the money follows the patient into the home with Jack and Jill. So if people have a little bit of extra cash coming up to Christmas, I know it's a tough year, please think local and support a local Irish children's charity where the money is going to make such a difference to local families.
Exactly. And just to finish up then, as you say, €6.1 million each year to run Jack and Jill, only 20% funded by the HSE, and the rest is raised through donations. And that's why the Christmas campaign is so vital. If people want to donate, then Carmel, how can they do so?
literally go on to jackandjill.ie, have a look at our beautiful candles up there, our cards. We have a local artist who did the cards for us, Pickle Pom Pom, Laura Dempsey there. In, she's a Kildare-based artist and they're available in Circle K. Look, we have cards. We have cookbooks there from Odlums that are available in Dunn stores. There's something there for everybody. We have art prints. So if you want to go on early and have a look at whether it's your cards or a candle or a cookbook or whatever you might like, please have a look at Jack and Jill. There'll be plenty of time to get them delivered to your home. Or you can pop down to Peter in Newbridge or to Mary there. And, you know, just go in and connect with Jack and Jill, because the great thing about it, Owen, is every €18 that we raise will fund 1 hour of home nursing care. So, you know, whether it's in Crookstown through the shop, Newbridge through the shop, or if you're passing through Dublin, we're about to open our first Dublin shop in Artane next week. You know, please think of ways that you can help Jack and Jill. And a shout out for the likes of Brendan Loughlin. And I know Moy Glare Residents Association are having a Christmas fundraiser for us on the 4th of December. And the likes of Callan Hair and Beauty there in Clane, they've organised a cheque collection for us. We get wonderful support across the county. Glenveagh, Bordnamona, you know, they all support us. So please keep going and think about Jack and Jill and have a look at the wonderful Christmas collection, knowing that you're helping local families. And a big shout out to all our lovely nurses out there as well. I'm so proud to launch this Christmas campaign and to keep it going. But boy, is it busy down in Johnstown at the moment. If you came in and stood still home for too long, we might sell a take you at the moment. There's some orders coming in, you know?
Very good, very good. Listen, the best of luck anyway over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be very, very busy. Looking forward to Christmas, and no doubt we'll be chatting to you before that anyway. That is Carmel Doyle, CEO of the Jack and Jill Foundation, launching their Christmas appeal. You can get more information on jackandjill.ie. Thanks, Carmel.